Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by BBC America, presenting The Office, the innovative British comedy about the banality of 9 to 5 in excruciating detail, Thursday nights at 10 on BBC America.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Easter is coming, celebrating the resurrection of Jesus Christ after his crucifixion. His scourging and crucifixion is the focus of the Mel Gibson film, The Passion of the Christ. We're going to take a historical look at crucifixion, which was a widespread form of punishment in antiquity. My guest, John Dominic Crossan, is Professor Emeritus of Religious Studies at DePaul University and author of the books The Birth of Christianity, Jesus, a Revolutionary Biography, and Who Killed Jesus? Crossan describes his work as combining faith and history. He's a former Roman Catholic monk in the Servite Order and the former co-chair of the Jesus Seminar, which investigates ancient historical evidence to help understand the life and times of Jesus. The seminar is controversial, in part because it does not take the Gospels literally and uses history to reconcile the different versions of Jesus' story as told in the four Gospels of the New Testament. I asked Crossan how long crucifixion was used as a form of execution.
Crucifixion was practiced as a form of, I would call it, state terrorism for centuries before it became infamous under the Romans.
And who practiced it?
Basically, the Carthaginians did it, the Greeks did it. It was one of the supreme penalties invented in and around the Mediterranean world.
Now, I was surprised to read in one of your books that there was, for a while, a Jewish practice of crucifixion. For what reason?
There's a difference between what I call living crucifixion and dead crucifixion. In dead crucifixion, the person is put to death, the criminal is put to death by, say, could be garrotted or strangled. And then literally the body is hung up as a warning, hung up dead, in other words. And there seems to be a tradition of that in some of the Jewish sources. The Roman crucifixion was living crucifixion. In other words, the person was impaled on the cross or on the stake while still alive and allowed to die in that position.
Now, who were some of the people that were typically punished with crucifixion?
In general, especially in the Roman situation, you can say almost definitely it was almost synonymous with the slave's execution. It was a warning to other slaves not to flee, not to commit a crime, not, of course, to kill their master or mistress. And it was extremely public. Its point was not so much the amount of suffering, though, of course, it was a horrible suffering, but it was a public warning. You were literally hung up like a poster. Don't do what this person did, or you'll end up as this person did. So very much for the lower classes, and especially for slaves.
Now, you say that during Roman times, crucifixion was one of three primary ways of capital punishment. There was crucifixion, being burned alive, and getting fed to the lions.
The Romans talked about suprema supplicia, supreme penalties, and they really didn't calculate them in terms of the amount of suffering. They really calculated them in terms of annihilation. So being crucified, being fed to the beasts, as it were, are being burned alive, the function was there would be nothing left to bury. So even when they were finished with your corpse, the relatives, the loved ones, would have nothing to bury. There'd be no tomb where they could mourn, where they could come to grieve, where they could even, say, eat with the beloved dead. They wished to annihilate you and to do it publicly.
Even with crucifixion?
The theory behind crucifixion actually was that you would be left on the cross until you were consumed by wild beasts or wild animals. Usually crucifixion was low enough so that the dogs who would, of course, packs of dogs who would play in a place like that all the time, could consume your body. It was a form of annihilation. Now, we know, for example, that there was one case in the first century because we have found the heel bone of a crucified person with the nail still in place, and this person was buried, honorably buried. So it is possible, of course. It depends upon whether maybe you could bribe the guards or have enough influence to get the body given to you. Then you could get the body back. But in theory, the purpose of crucifixion was to leave the body there until there was nothing left.
Was scourging or whipping usually the first step before crucifixion?
In general, scourging preceded crucifixion. And the function of scourging, the primary function of scourging, again, was not simply to create suffering. If they wanted to, if the function of suffering was that the poor person would be kept in the barracks and tortured for weeks, the function of scourging was to reduce resistance. They did not want a person, for example, staggering through the streets with a crossbar, cursing Rome or fighting them all the way. What you wanted, this was public spectacle, what you wanted was somebody reduced to the state that the most it could do was stagger, as it were, to crucifixion, unresisting. So yes, usually scourging would have presumed, would have preceded crucifixion.
In your book, Who Killed Jesus?, you quote a couple of the historic references to crucifixion, including the Jewish historian Josephus, and let me read a short paragraph that you quote by him. "They were whipped, their bodies were mutilated, and while they were still alive and breathing, they were crucified, while their wives and the sons whom they had circumcised in spite of the king's wishes were strangled, the children being made to hang from the necks of their crucified parents." And that's from the book Jewish Antiquities. I've never heard this before, that children were also killed while the father was being crucified and the child was hung by the neck of the father on the cross?
I think probably what you have read there is the most horrible example that we have in the whole of the ghastly literature about crucifixion. That women were probably crucified, I think, is absolutely certain. What was done to the children is probably best not even imagined, because the function of crucifixion, again, is state terrorism. And when, for example, the legions marched, they did not want to have to come back for one or two generations, so they made a terrible example of what they were doing to deter future resistance.
Here's another quote from Josephus from the book Jewish Wars. "They were accordingly scourged and subjected to torture of every description before being killed, and then crucified opposite the walls, 500 or sometimes more being captured daily. The soldiers, out of rage and hatred, amused themselves by nailing their prisoners in different postures, and so great was their number that space could not be found for the crosses, nor crosses for the bodies." Put that in context for us.
The context of that is the destruction of Jerusalem, the burning of the temple by Titus in the year 70 of the Common Era. And what is happening is either Jews who are trying to escape from the doomed city, or who'd been captured after its fall. Josephus says 500 a day were being crucified until they almost ran out of wood. And one of the things that's emphasized there is that there is no definite way in which a person could be crucified. I mean, it wasn't that everyone had to be on a cross and the cross had to look like this. It could be on a stake. It could be on a tree. It could be anything that literally, and it's a horrible way to put it, but this is what they are doing. They are hanging up a warning, as it were, on the wall. The mutilated body of a crucified person had become a poster for "don't do this."
How does Jesus' crucifixion, as described in the Gospels, compare with what is known historically about the procedures of crucifixion?
In general, the crucifixion itself, and in a way the Gospel has only one word. They crucified him. They don't describe the details that would show up, for example, in a play or a film. You don't have to decide if you're reading the Gospel, does Jesus carry only the crossbar, or does he pull a huge cross and upright already in position? It simply says it crucified him. Another thing it does tell you is that the crime, as it were, the claim, the alleged claim of being king of the Jews was the sign given that you'd always have in a crucifixion, saying this is what this person did. So the crime is, as it were, hung around his neck or attached to the cross in some way. But everything that's said about the crucifixion of Jesus would fit quite well into what you'd expect in the first century crucifixion.
And it said he was scourged, and it said he was mocked.
The mocking is probably a separate issue. And in one sense, the mocking is terribly ironic, because he's been mocked as a pseudo-king. And of course, any reader of the Christian New Testament, the Christian Gospel, believes profoundly that he was a king, far more than Caesar was or Pilate as a local governor, that their mocking was profoundest truth. So in a way, the Gospel spends far more time, if you count the verses, I think there's about four verses on the mocking, and there's only one single word in Greek for the scourging. They wanted to describe the mocking because of the tremendous irony that the soldiers mocked him as a king. I have no idea whether that is historical or not. They certainly could have, but the point of insisting on it is the irony that he was being mocked as a king, and of course, we Christians who are reading this gospel believe him most profoundly to be king, not just of the Jews, but of the world.
When did the cross become a symbol of Christianity?
Very, 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 very slowly and cautiously. In the time before Constantine, that is, before the beginning of the 4th century, when Christianity became more or less the official religion of the Roman Empire, you have very, very many mentions, of course, from Paul's letters on of the cross, of the crucifixion, but you don't see pictures of it. The very earliest one we have, actually, of the crucifixion is, again, we're back to the mocking. A page in the Palatine Palace in Rome was mocking a fellow page who apparently was a Christian. His name was Alexandros. So the page scratched on the wall of their dormitory, as it were, a model of the crucifixion in which Jesus is portrayed with the head of a donkey. And written underneath it is, Alexander worships his God. And probably that's the only way it would have been shown as a mocking of the crucifixion until after the victory of Constantine.
Have you thought about if so many people were crucified, if it was such a common form of execution, why did that become the symbol for Jesus Christ?
The crucifix only became, or the cross only became the symbol for Jesus always as accompanied by the resurrection. I mean, this is two things, execution, resurrection, mm-hmm. death, resurrection, always the two things. Because, of course, the point is that Jesus was officially, legally, publicly executed by Rome. It wasn't that Pilate made a mistake or that Pilate simply was rounding up people and he grabbed Jesus by mistake. Jesus was executed by the normalcy of the civilization of his day. Then, of course, when you say that God raised Jesus from the dead, you've got two things on a collision course. Rome crucified Jesus. God raised Jesus. Then the inference is very clear. This God we're talking about is on a collision course with Rome, because God had, as it were, countermanded the official decree of Rome. And so if you take away the resurrection, then the crucifixion becomes almost meaningless, or you have to get into another theology in which the crucifixion is the center of Christianity all by itself.
When you, as someone who studies the historical Jesus, think about the resurrection, do you think about it as metaphor or as actuality?
I think of it, I would not make the distinction of metaphor or actuality. I would make the distinction of metaphor or literal, because metaphors can be very actual. For example, the metaphor for me is that to claim resurrection for Jesus, and I can leave it completely, whether you take it metaphorically or literally, either way, what you are claiming is that something has happened here which is going to change the way the world sees everything. And I think that is right, because the claim you're making is that God has reversed the normalcy of civilization. And that's why it's very important for me to insist that Pilate, from his point of view, got it right. He looked at Jesus. He said, this person resists our law and order, as it were, not a violent resister, or had rounded up all his followers like I rounded up Barabbas's. But yes, he resists us, and therefore he must be publicly executed. Now, to say that God has reversed that decision puts God on a collision course with the normalcy of civilization. That, I believe, is actual, because I believe in what happened at the death of Jesus is that we were confronted with a warning that violence is going to destroy us. We got a warning that if you do not resist evil nonviolently, violence will destroy us. I think something did happen, because that was a warning, and we have not been heeding it for 2,000 years.
My guest is John Dominic Crossan, Professor Emeritus of Religious Studies at DePaul University and former co-chair of the Jesus Seminar. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Dominic Crossan, former co-chair of the Jesus Seminar, which uses ancient history to understand the life and times of Jesus. When we left off, we were talking about his interpretation of the resurrection. With the resurrection, do you think that there was some kind of physical transformation that happened to the actual body of Jesus?
No, I don't. I am completely convinced that Jesus had told people before his death that the kingdom of God has already arrived and that we have begun to participate with God in what I'm going to call the great cleanup. The fancy word for that is eschatological consummation. The great cleanup of the world, the attempt to make it a just place. I am absolutely certain also, historically I'm speaking, that people had visions of Jesus after his execution. They had visions, they are not hallucinations, they are visions, they are apparitions of Jesus. When they put those two things together, they said, then Jesus has risen as the beginning of the general resurrection. That's the only thing the word could have meant to them. It's not a personal, private privilege for Jesus. He has risen as the head of those who have died before him and as the promise of those who will die after him. I take that metaphorically. I do not take it actually. I do not think all around Jerusalem on Easter Sunday morning there were hundreds of empty tombs. And I don't think the people who believed in the harrowing of hell ever suggested, let's go out and check the tombs of the prophets to see if they're gone. I think they knew quite well what they were saying. They were saying something which they took metaphorically and which we take literally. And I think we've kind of lost the actuality.
Now, something that I find a little confusing, when we were talking a little earlier about crucifixion, you were explaining that for most Roman crucifixions, the dead body was left on the cross to be eaten by the birds of prey and by the wild dogs. And part of that was punishment for the family. The family would not be given the remains to be buried. There'd be no tomb, there'd be no remains. But the remains of Jesus is such a fundamental part of the Christ story. Do you think an exception was made for him, that there were remains, that there was a body?
It's utterly possible because of the Philo, for example, does mention the possibility of a body being given back to the family. And in a way, it's not so much a punishment for the family as a punishment for the person because they're being annihilated. And we have the crucified heel bone of somebody who is honorably buried. So it is utterly possible that in an exceptional case, either because you bribed the guards or because you were able to get some influence, it was utterly possible to get the body and give the body normal burial. Now, the problem is that the Jewish law of Deuteronomy says by nightfall the body must be off the cross. I have no evidence, and I expect that the Romans did not follow Jewish law, because the purpose of crucifixion was to let you die in agony on the cross. And if the person, let's imagine a case in which the person was only crucified by late in the afternoon, they would not be taken down from the cross. So the question is, and this is the question, is the story of Joseph of Arimathea in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, or of Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus in John, is that an historical record of what happened? Is that Christians' best hope of what they hope might have happened without knowing what happened to the body of Jesus?
So you think that the Gospels might be more about that hope than the reality, more about hope than journalism?
Here is the problem. When you look at Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John, the story of the burial of Jesus, knowing that Mark is the basis for Matthew and Luke, and that possibly, this is debated in scholarship, they may be the source for John. You watch the body's burial get steadily better. It's a hasty, hurried burial in Mark. By the time Matthew and Luke read Mark and develop the story, it's burial in a tomb in which nobody else has been laid, and they're explaining to you why Joseph of Arimathea was able to be a counselor for Jesus but not against him on Thursday night, as it were. The story is developing, and by the time you get to John's account, the burial of Jesus is, I wouldn't even say royal, it's transcendental. There are so much spices used that they would fill almost the entire tomb. It's a magnificent burial. It's the burial of the Son of God when you get to John. Now, what happens is, as a historian, when I retroject that trajectory of a burial getting better and better and better, and I ask what was there in the beginning, it doesn't look very good. It looks to me like all they might have had at the very beginning is a hope that maybe some pious, non-Christian Jew, out of respect for the law of Deuteronomy, would have buried Jesus' body. But that immediately then raises the issue that they see, well, wouldn't he also have buried the two robbers who were crucified with Jesus? And wouldn't there be at least three in the tomb? And would it be a public tomb for criminals? And then how would we know which was Jesus' body? And so you can see them, I think, grappling with the difficulties of a story which I don't think is historical. I think it is their fervent hope, their best hope, that somebody took care of the body of Jesus. But none of that, by the way, in any way, is for or against resurrection, because resurrection is a new creation by God.
Religion scholar John Dominic Crossan will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with John Dominic Crossan, professor emeritus of religious studies at DePaul University. He describes his work as combining faith and history. He's a former monk in the Servite Order and the former co-chair of the Jesus Seminar, which turns to ancient history to understand the life and times of Jesus. The Jesus Seminar has been controversial because it focuses on history and doesn't accept the Gospels as literal truth. Crossan's books include The Birth of Christianity and Who Killed Jesus? I know that you've seen Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion of the Christ, and I'm wondering if you could give us your short review of how the Jesus story is told in the movie.
I've seen it twice, a month apart. I saw it at the end of January and again at the end of February, so I had a good month in to think about it. Basically, there's a couple of things that any passion story or passion drama does. You take the four Gospels, and there are four of them, by the way, and you reduce them to one. And then you reduce that one Gospel to simply execution. And then you reduce that execution to passio, the Latin word for passion, meaning suffering. So everything coalesces on the suffering of Jesus. Therefore, for example, there is nothing in Mel Gibson's movie, except brief flashbacks, more to increase the poignancy, about the life of Jesus. So by the time you come to the execution, and the resurrection, of course, is even more fleeting in this movie, you have no idea why anyone at all would want this person dead, let alone executed publicly. You don't even understand it. Nor do you understand why, for example, it begins with a nighttime arrest of Jesus accompanied by Judas, who betrays him. Why was that necessary? Couldn't the authorities have grabbed him any time they wanted? Well, if you've been reading the story from Palm Sunday on, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, as we would say, of that week, the crowd is all on the side of Jesus. It's said again and again and again in the gospel, the high priestly authorities are afraid to move because the crowd are on the side of Jesus. And in Mark 14, 1 to 2, they give up. They finally say, well, we can't do it during the festival. There'll be a riot. Then comes Judas. And Judas says, I can arrange it. I can arrange that you'll get him apart from the crowd at night. So what is not in this movie at all is that the whole Jewish crowd in Jerusalem is so much on the side of Jesus that it requires this nighttime arrest and an apostolic traitor to get him. And there's none of that in this movie. All the Jews that are in this movie, except for what I'm going to call Christian Jews, are people like Simon of Cyrene, who are converted into Christians. All the non-Christian Jews are bad. They simply are. And it doesn't work to say everyone is a Jew, because it's quite clear, for example, that Simon of Cyrene becomes a good Jew when he becomes a Christian.
When did passion plays become popular? When did it become popular to focus stories on the suffering, the crucifixion and suffering of Christ?
The emphasis on the suffering of Christ, almost the exclusion of everything else, is really a very much a medieval idea and may well reflect the experiences of people. If people are suffering, and I mean seriously suffering, say with plague or something like that, or invasion, then to think of the sufferings of Jesus is extremely consoling. And the script that Mel Gibson used from the Dolorous Passion of Our Lord Jesus Christ, according to the Meditations of Anne Catherine Emmerich, is a good example. She had a life of suffering. She had a life of hardship, an Augustinian nun who spent the last 10 years of her life bedridden in great pain. And no wonder, of course, that she had an almost mystical union with the sufferings of Jesus, because she herself was in intense suffering. So the emphasis on suffering is, how shall I say it, appropriate maybe even necessary for people in intolerable pain. Outside that, it becomes dangerously close to pathological.
What do you mean by pathological?
I mean, when you start to focus on suffering and the whole meaning of, say, Jesus' life being reduced, and that verb is carefully chosen, reduced to suffering, it is not the way anyone thought about it in the first century. The Romans did not compute suffering. They didn't say, we have to make this person suffer as much as possible, or they would have kept him in the barracks and tortured him for weeks on end. Their purpose was not suffering, but public warning. So when you bring it all down to suffering, it's very hard to show it without sadism. And that's what happens in this movie. How can you show 2 hours of unrelenting brutality and ask people to watch it and ask people to feel that they want it to happen because it's their redemption? So you have to be, as it were, on the side of the Roman soldiers. You have to want it. You can't even agree with that Jewish woman who cries out in the crowd, somebody stop this. You can't. You are being co-opted into collusion with sadism. And I think there is no evidence that I know of that the soldiers who scourged Jesus were sadistic brutes, as they're shown in the movie. They could have just been executioners doing their dirty job, wanting to get it over and get back to the barracks. So when you emphasize suffering to that extent, it is almost impossible not to slip over into sadism or even into religious pornography.
You know, when you say that the Romans weren't interested in sadism and suffering, they just wanted to set a public example, but isn't the whole point of the public example that you don't want to be the victim of sadists and that you don't want to suffer? So isn't it finally really about sadism and suffering?
It's a very delicate line, I agree with you. But did a person who was scourged and crucified suffer? Of course, of course. But, for example, by insisting on the public nature of it, they were insisting on their priorities. Their priority was not to make the person suffer. Their priority was to make a public example of this person. For example, if they scourged the person and the person died, they have failed. They have failed in their purpose. If the person simply died under the scourging, that's not their purpose. If the person died on the way to crucifixion, they failed again. They have to get the person to the cross, to die on the cross. That is their purpose. So, of course, there is suffering.
My guest is John Dominic Crossan, Professor Emeritus of Religious Studies at DePaul University and former co-chair of the Jesus Seminar. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Dominic Crossan, former co-chair of the Jesus Seminar, which interprets ancient history to help understand the life and times of Jesus. Crossan's books include The Birth of Christianity and Who Killed Jesus? Let me ask you about one of the key figures in the story of Jesus, and that is Pontius Pilate.
Okay.
What was his actual position in the Roman Empire?
Pontius Pilate was what could best be described as a sub-governor. He was the governor of the southern part of the Jewish homeland of Judea, Samaria, and Idumea. Antipas, Herod Antipas, was running Galilee. But Pilate, was under the governor, let's call him a first-level governor of Syria, who could hire him and fire him, as it were. Well, maybe couldn't hire him, but he could certainly fire him because he did. So he's a very ambiguous character. He is not really a full governor. He's a kind of a sub-governor. Secondly, he was in for 10 years, and most governors were in only for 2 years. He probably didn't like his job. He probably was fed up and tired. 10 years is a long time, even though, let's see, he came in 26, so the crucifixion was probably only 4 years into his tenure. The other thing he had to deal with was he was dealing with a temple state, as it were. He would be used to dealing with aristocrats like himself in any other part of the empire, but here he had to deal with a high priest. And he could, in this case, hire and fire that high priest. So it's a very bad administrative situation if the person that you must negotiate with in charge of the indigenous people that you're governing, you can fire that person. How do you negotiate with somebody who can fire you? So there's lots of problems with Pilate, simply from an administrative point of view, before we get to his character or anything else.
What do you know about his character?
Of all the governors, or all the sub-governors, if you will, of the Jewish homeland in the first century, we know more about Pilate probably than anyone else. Some of the other ones, we only know their names. But we know from the Jewish historian Josephus and the Jewish philosopher Philo a lot about Pilate. And what's really ironic is that precisely what they insist on, from Philo, for example, his gratuitous cruelty and his tendency to put people to death without proper trial, and from Josephus, his brutal way with handling even unarmed crowds, exactly what they focus on, show us a Pilate who is the exact opposite of the sort of a just person doing his level best to free an innocent person and just forced by this shouting crowd to go along with the crucifixion against his best will and just kind of finally giving in, maybe a little weak, but you know, trying to prevent a riot. That's exactly almost the precise opposite of what Philo and Josephus tell us about him.
Who were the Jewish priests in the time of Jesus who called for the execution of Jesus? Who was this class of people?
The high priests were certain aristocratic families, basically about four predominant ones, from whom the high priest was appointed, and appointed by the Roman authorities, by the way, not by any sort of election of their own people, during the first century. So, for example, the most important house or family was the house of Annas, because they had about eight high priests in about 60 years, so they are almost the dominant one. Caiaphas, for example, the high priest at the time of Jesus' execution, was the son-in-law of Annas, who had been high priest before him, and Caiaphas was in for almost 17 years. So the high priest would represent, as far as the Romans were concerned at least, the leadership of the Jewish people. And they had to negotiate with the Romans as best they could while they were really under the Romans.
And is there any historical information about how the Jewish common people felt about the priestly class?
It's very, very interesting that in Mark's Gospel, just to take that for an example, consistently on what we call Palm Sunday, Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday of that Holy Week, it's said repeatedly, every day in fact, that the people of Jerusalem, presumably, are so much on the side of Jesus that the high priestly authority, who consider him dangerous and who consider that he might bring the Romans down on them like a ton of marble, as it were, that they are against him, but they cannot move against him because the crowd is supporting him so much. And in fact, in Mark 14:1-2, the high priestly authority finally say, we give up. We can't do it during the festival. There might be a riot in support of Jesus. So that, of course, is the reason why it becomes necessary to have a Judas who will locate Jesus at night, who will locate Jesus apart from the supporting crowd, and whom the high priestly authorities then can get under their control.
Historically, is there any evidence that the Jewish priests called for the execution of Jesus? And if there is evidence of that, what are some of the historical explanations for it?
The Jewish historian Josephus sums up what happened to Jesus by saying that the first men among us, that would be the leaders, accused him before Pilate, and Pilate crucified him. And I think that is the most precise and accurate summary you can give to the question, who killed Jesus? The high priestly aristocracy and the Roman leadership both agreed that Jesus was dangerous. And I think they both agreed he was not a violent revolutionary, or they would have rounded up all his followers. They agreed that he was, however, what we might call a nonviolent resistor against Roman law and order. And it's not at all necessary to demonize somebody like Caiaphas, nor to canonize somebody like Pilate. It made good administrative sense from the Roman point of view that Jesus could, unwittingly maybe, start a rebellion. He was talking about the kingdom of God, and as far as Rome was concerned, that was Rome. So Caiaphas and Pilate could have agreed without any problem that Jesus was a danger. But all the evidence is that the people were not on the side of Caiaphas.
So when you look at the question, you know, were the Jews responsible for the execution of Jesus? How do you answer that?
The statement that Jews were responsible for Jesus is an irresponsible statement. Some Jews opposed Jesus. We know, for example, that the high priestly authority under Caiaphas opposed Jesus. We also know that the crowd, that's the word that Mark uses consistently in the days before the execution of Jesus, was on his side to the point of opposing their own high priestly authorities. That has to be shown in any story that's even accurate to the Gospels. I'm not even talking about historical accuracy behind the Gospels. If you want to tell the Gospel story, you have to show that the crowd in Jerusalem on the days preceding, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, are so much in favor of Jesus and so much in support of Jesus that the high priestly authorities almost give up, and it takes Judas, really, to give them the solution.
You were a monk for several years.
Right.
How many?
I was a monk for 19 years in a 13th century Roman Catholic order called the Servites.
Then you left the order and became a scholar eventually of the historical Jesus. Is there any way of telling us briefly why you left the order and then turned to scholarship?
I left the order for two reasons. One was to get married, and that was quite adequate reason all by itself. And the other one was, even if I could have stayed and got married, is that I was in constant trouble with the religious superiors, the Cardinal Archbishop of Chicago, because I'd been magnificently trained by my order to think. And as soon as I proceeded to do it, some of the conclusions I came to were not acceptable. And unfortunately, I've been trained to think and not to think under control. So there was a constant tension with my religious superiors in the Archdiocese of Chicago, not with the order.
Can you give us an example of something that you, a conclusion that you arrived at, or a question that you kept thinking about because you were thinking independently, that was criticized within your order?
Well, in one sense, the final one was in 1968, when the papal encyclical condemning birth control was issued. I was invited to be on national public television, in this case in Chicago, and I said basically that I thought the Pope was wrong on this one, but as far as I was concerned, he was still the Pope, in much the same way as I thought the President was wrong about Vietnam, but he was still the President. And somehow or other, that did not seem to go down too well. But it was the truth. That's the way I felt. The Pope was the Pope, but wrong. The President was the President, but wrong. And that more or less brought down the Cardinal Archbishop of Chicago. Not my order, by the way, I say that again. But the Cardinal Archbishop of Chicago asked my religious superior to show cause why I should not be tossed out of the diocese within 1 week.
So you left the order under pressure.
Right.
But you stayed within religion. I don't know if you continued to practice it in the same way, but you certainly became a scholar of the religion. Did you want to keep practicing after that, or were you so disturbed by how you were treated that you wanted to just be a scholar and not a practicing Christian?
Oh, no, not at all, not at all. And I should insist, I do not consider at all that I was treated badly. There was lots of other people suffered far more because they wanted to remain a priest and had to leave, say, to get married. I had already made my decision that I wanted to leave the priesthood even if I could get married and stay a priest,
right,
because of the constant tension about theology. So I did not really have the trauma that some people did. And what I wanted to do was exactly what I did. I wanted to go to a Roman Catholic university, and I went to, if I may say so, a very great one, DePaul University in Chicago. Stayed there for 26 years. Never even considered moving. Told anyone that I had no intention of moving. I loved it. And it, part of it was the Roman Catholic atmosphere, but it was the Roman Catholic atmosphere in which I could think freely.
John Dominic Crossan, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure as always, Terry.
John Dominic Crossan is Professor Emeritus of Religious Studies at DePaul University and former co-chair of the Jesus Seminar. His books include Who Killed Jesus and The Birth of Christianity. This is Fresh Air.